Welcome to the Militant Grind Show, where we dive deep into the journeys of those who've mastered the art of being their best selves. Every episode is a testament to resilience, dedication, and the pursuit of excellence, embodying our tagline, the most honorables. Here you'll find inspiration, insights, and strategies to elevate your life in every aspect. For more empowering content and to join our community of achievers, visit us at militantgrind.com. Let's embark on this journey together because the grind never stops. Are you ready for a radical transformation? Join the ranks of the most honorables. Our proven methods forge resilience, sharpen strategic thinking, and unlock your true potential. We'll challenge you mentally, physically, and spiritually, preparing you to overcome any obstacle. Visit militantgrindacademy.com and begin your evolution. Greatness awaits. Forge your path, ignite your future. Most of all, join the movement.
Welcome to the Militant Grind podcast with our guest, Reverend Dr. David Chaka, founder of Spirit Equip Ministries and leader of the Alliance Pray Team. With a global ministry spanning continents and a deep educational background in theology, Dr. Chaka specializes in spiritual disciplines and intercessory prayer across denominational lines. Today, we explore the transformative power of prayer and spirituality under Dr. Chaka's guidance, drawing on extensive experience and mentorship from leading theological figures. Join us for an enlightening discussion on the universal call to deeper spirituality. David, how are you today, sir?
I am very well indeed and very thankful to be on your podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome. I had to say all these big words before I...
Correctly. You said most of them correctly.
Right. Man, yeah. So you are Canadian. I interview a lot of Canadians and you guys are like very enlightened, aware, self-aware. And I always get some of the greatest advice about life from Canadians. And I ended up noticing that a lot of Canadians are funny. Like you guys are
because we're laughing at ourselves all the time.
Oh, really? That's what it is.
Yes.
Yeah, because it was funny growing up, me loving Jim Carrey, and then me figuring out that Jim Carrey is Canadian.
I was yes, like, he is. What? Yeah. Don't forget Captain Kirk, and don't forget Celine Dion. Right? You got them right there too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Captain James T. Kirk was born in Montreal. That's where he was from.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So a lot of my favorite people, Drake isn't my favorite, but you know,
Christopher Plummer was born in Montreal as well. So the guy who was, that's a very famous actor as well.
Oh, really? And there was another one, I think Ryan Reynolds.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
The guy who played First Man in Barbie, what's his name? The guy who just, he was in the Oscars. The fellow who did the first man, the movie about the moon. This is awful. I can't remember his name.
A man on the moon?
Yeah, there was a movie called First Man. It was about 2 years ago.
Oh,
he played Ken and Barbie in Barbie. So he just played that. He's a Canadian as well.
Oh, not Ryan Gosling.
That's him. Yes, he's Canadian.
He's Canadian?
Yes, he is.
I thought he was from Tennessee for some reason. Oh, no, he was just on Mickey Mouse Clubhouse with Justin Timberlake, who's from Tennessee. Yeah, wow. Yeah, you guys produce some pretty solid people. And one thing I liked about you and your story is how you just embrace like a lot of denominations and put it into like one. And yeah, especially when it comes to the Bible, because me, I read the Bible, I read the Quran, I have the Kabbalah, I have the Apocrypha. I have like all of these different spirituality texts that I read and I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna use that and become like a spirituality superhero. So I'm getting information from the Buddhists and the Hebrews and all kind of cultures. It's an African spirituality as well. And then one thing that I've noticed myself is that the majority of them say the same thing.
Well, there's lots and lots of commonality. So actually, you know how I wound up becoming quite multi-denominational is a better way to say it. Mm-hmm. The word trans has all kinds of other things attached to it now. So say multi-denominational. Mm-hmm. But when I first started in the ministry, I wound up at a little tiny town in Northeast Alberta. The name of the town was Lac La Biche. Now, it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. Mm-hmm. Actually, the road literally ends at Lac La Biche. And in the wintertime, when it gets to like 40 below, there's an ice road that goes north to Fort McMurray. but it was a very small little town, but it had a wonderful population of people. And they were from all over the earth. And so in that town, you had five or six different ethnics. And so because the town is small, you talk to all the ethnics. And there was a Muslim mosque in that town. There was a Ukrainian Orthodox Church, a Roman Catholic Church that went back to the foundations of Canadian history, with some of the founding of the country that almost became the capital of Alberta, but the town burned to the ground and they moved it to Fort Edmonton. But regardless of this, I wound up in a prayer meeting with the local pastors there. And so there was myself, and the closest equivalent in the United States would be a Methodist. Okay, so there was me, and there was an Anglican guy. There was a Roman Catholic priest named Giuseppe Peroni. And he was a delightful fellow. There was a Ukrainian Orthodox pastor. There was a Evangelical Free Church pastor, and there was a Pentecostal and me. That's we tried to meet together once a week to talk and pray for in with each other, and we always argued. So we always, oh no, my way's better. No, your way's better. No, my way's better. No, your way. So here's what happened. We made a decision that we would use the standard readings for all of our churches once a week. And we began to pray with each other once a week, listening to the scripture before we would speak. We'd say hello, we'd have a cup of coffee or tea, we'd have cakes and muffins or something like that. And we'd do 1 month at a time in one location, and then 1 month at a time in the next location, and so on. And I must tell you, it was one of the most amazing experiences, because when you argue with a Catholic, you're going to argue. When you pray with a Catholic, you listen. When you argue with a Ukrainian Orthodox priest, you argue. When you listen to an Orthodox priest, you listen. And we listened to the Lord together as we shared around the thing that we held in common, which was the Bible. And that education brought me to a place where I recognized that there really are three class extremes in Christianity. There's sacramental, there's evangelical, and there's charismatic. And these three streams, what happens is the sacramental says, oh no, only us are Christians. They draw a little line. And then the evangelical says, oh no, only us are Christians, and they draw a little line. And the charismatic says, oh no, only us are Christians, and they draw a little line. And it doesn't work. Each one of those streams has beauty. Each one of those streams has an historic component where people who were trying to live out their faith inside historical context made decisions about how they're going to shape the way they worship. And if you listen carefully to each of those streams, you discover the beauty. Now, listen, you want to criticize them? Oh, yeah, I can do that. I can criticize myself too. But where nothing is gained. Nothing is gained by fighting fellow believers. Everything is gained by praying with them. Everything is gained by partnering with them, and so on. So that's one of the most important things. And there was something that happened there out of that led to my transformation. I don't know if you like you have hardly introduced me, so I don't know if you want to go this way or
Nah, go
not.
ahead, go ahead.
Well, here's what happened. I had an experience where I belonged to my own particular denomination. We were trying to organize a meeting, and I was the leader of this particular group, and it was a large piece of geography with small churches in it. There were 19 churches in my association. In those days, it was called a presbytery, and all the pastors of these churches have all voted that they wanted to do a faith in the family event. I said, oh, isn't that nice? And they said, yes, David, you're going to lead it. So it meant driving 2 hours and meeting a bunch of other leaders from across that jurisdiction and spending a day doing our planning. And we had to plan out how much money it was going to be, how long we were going to, how much lead time we needed, the location, what we're going to pay the speaker, who is the speaker going to be, et cetera, et cetera. And so we spent the whole ready day doing that. We were little churches, didn't have any money. And we wanted to bring in the big names. Sherman, I must tell you, if you saw the list of people that we said were going to be considered for speaker, you would have been impressed. We got the top speakers from across the world. And so our first one was a top speaker. Our second was a top speaker. Our third was a top speaker. Number four was somebody who would do the event for $50, love offering and gas. Number five was somebody who'd do it for a love offering and gas. And so the whole committee looked at me and they said, David, you're dreaming in Technicolor if you think we can get these three get these three speakers. And they said, why don't you start at number four? And if that person can't do it, then go into number five. And if number five can't do it, find somebody and we'll do our event 6 months from now. And we all laughed together, and I drove home and I thought, isn't that crazy? So the next morning, I was ne this is from 1985, so it's an old story. And the reason I'm telling you the date is because phones have changed from 1985 to now. back in the day, you used to have to pay $50 for a phone call across the Canadian-U.S. border just to get your information. And there was a charge per minute after that.
Golly.
Yeah, it's very expensive. And so our budget was $50 and a love offer. So we didn't have any money, right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's Monday morning after the Sunday meeting. I'm in my office. I'm in charge, and I have to make the phone call to contact who the speaker's going to be. Mm-hmm. And all of the committee has said, I can proceed as I feel led. And I thought, okay, I'll call number four. And if four doesn't work, I'll call number five. And I knelt down to do my morning prayers. And it was a terrifically ordinary time. I had people that I was praying for because they were injured or in a hospital. I had friends that I wanted to have care given to them, et cetera, et cetera. And I prayed my praise hymn, and I prayed my prayer for all the friends that I knew, et cetera, et cetera. I sang a hymn of praise, ended with the Lord's Prayer, and I stood to my feet and I thought, I should probably pray about whether or not we're going to invite these people to this event. See, we should ask. And so I knelt down beside my desk to have another 10 minutes in prayer. And I said, Lord, should we invite the number one person on this list to come to our presbytery to do an event? And this was a defining moment for my life. My interior being collapsed inwardly. I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach. And I took that to be no. And then the next thing that happened was the defining moment. I have been a Christian follower since 1974, and right on through. So we're coming up on 50 years of believer. Mm-hmm. And I've been a pastor since 1983, and this has only happened one time in my life, one time. Mm-hmm. So I want to make clear that this is not an ordinary thing. But in the middle of this, I see this picture come into my brain. Now, have you ever been to North Dakota? You've been to North Dakota?
Not at all.
Okay. Well, if anybody, you're from Los Angeles, so you just don't get this. But there are flat highways where there are no trees. So there's a Bible school in South Saskatchewan called Briarcrest. And the joke is nobody can escape from there. And mm-hmm. we say, why not? They said, because you can see them for 26 miles down the road as they try to escape. Wow. Flat prairie, just flat as flat can be. Yeah. So I saw one of those highways. And this was November of 1985. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the highways, there were two calendars overlapping, February, March, 1987. And then I heard a voice, and the voice said, call this man, ask him to come to your church, not to the presbytery, and he will come then. And I just felt commanded. So I went over to my bookshelf. I grabbed one of the books off that he'd written. He'd written at that point 20 books. And I opened up to the name of the author. It was InterVarsity Press. So I phoned 411 across the border. That's my first $50. And I said, oh, by the way, could you give me the phone number for InterVarsity Press? And they said, yes. And then I phoned my second $50 by calling InterVarsity Press. And I said, oh, by the way, can I have the name of this, the phone number of this author? And they gave it to me. And then I phoned one more time. So it's already $150 and our budget is $50 and a love offering.
Wow.
So I call him. And a man with an English accent answers the phone. And he says, hello. I said, hello, my name is David Chotka. You probably don't know me, but I'm a pastor in a small little church in Northeast Alberta. And he said, well, that's all very fine and well, with his beautiful English diction and a very well-mannered kind of voice. He said, thank you, David. I do want to know one thing. How did you get my phone number? I said, well, I called InterVarsity and they gave me the number. And suddenly the nice English man became very angry. And he said, I told them to give that number to no one. No one. I changed my phone number yesterday. That was supposed to be for their business purposes, for their business purposes alone. They were not supposed to distribute that number to anybody. No one. I thought, oh, no, there goes my $150. I was a poor pastor. I didn't have any money. And then I said, listen, please, please don't get anybody in trouble. Here's what I will do. I will hang up the phone. I'll tear up the note. Please don't get anybody in InterVarsity Press in trouble. Somebody made a rookie mistake. Please forgive them. And he said, no, no, talk to me, talk to me. It might be Jesus. It might be Jesus. He said, I said, okay. And then Sherman, I made a bad mistake. I sinned. The voice had told me to not ask him to come to the presbytery, but to come to my church. And I said, oh, would you come to an area-wide gathering to teach on faith in the family? You've written a book called Parents in Pain. Would you come? And he said, no. As soon as I said it, I had this awful feeling in my stomach, like I'd done the wrong thing. And he said, no, I have a policy. After I read a book, 3 months later, I don't speak on that subject anymore. And it keeps me fresh. And I said, I am so sorry. I have just sinned against the voice that I heard. I am so sorry. I'm supposed to ask if you would come to my little church. It's got 60 people on a weekend. It's a 2-hour drive over gravel road from the Edmonton International Airport. Would you come to my church? And he paused and he said, the size doesn't matter. Yes. Yes, I must come to your church, but I have three conditions. And I thought, okay, here's the big thing. He's going to ask for a 4-star hotel. He's going to ask for a 2-year lease. He's going to ask for a big hunk. And he said, number one, I will pay my own airfare and bear my own expenses. Number two, you will not pay me anything. And number three, I must mentor you for a year or I will not come. I said, what? And he said, number one, I pay my own airfare and bear my own expenses. Number two, you won't pay me. And number three, I have to mentor you for at least a year or I will not come. Now, Sherman, I did not pray. I just said, yes. And then he said this. He said, well, I got a problem. I can't come until February or March of 1987. I said, I know. He said, how did you know? So I told him about the experience in the prayer time, about my getting this check in my soul around the asking him to the presbytery and about the vision and the highway and the two calendars. And he said, well, that's very interesting. I have been studying the movement of the Holy Spirit in the evangelical tradition. Mm-hmm. And if you would have me speak about that subject, I will come to your church in February, March of 1987. I said, sure. So I hung up the phone. I'm all excited. And the next day is the ministerial meeting with all these different pastors and priests, right? Mm-hmm. So we're all gathered around. And of course, the rule is you don't say anything until you've had your coffee. And after that, we listen to the scriptures that are standard for the day. And here's what happened in that prayer time. And it's astonishing. So the first reading was the story of the prophet Samuel pouring oil on the head of a guy named David who became the king of Israel and wrote the Psalms, okay? The second reading was the apostle Paul praying for a young man named Timothy, saying he'd become like a son to him in the faith, and he had a mother and a grandmother who were taking care of him. And the third reading was Jesus of Nazareth spending all night in prayer so he could select the 12 so that they could become the apostles.
Hmm.
And the last reading was a psalm of praise, but we start to pray. And suddenly, the evangelical free church pastor, a Mennonite guy named Henry Fries, says, Oh, God, nobody ever trained me. Nobody ever mentored me. When I lived in Winnipeg, Dr. John White was on faculty over at the University of Manitoba. Well, that was the guy. Dr. John White was on faculty at the University of Manitoba, and I wanted him to mentor me. I would go to pastor's days, and he was there, and he finishes his prayer with an amen. The guy next to him was the Orthodox priest, and he say, oh, God, I be speaking for to you, you be speaking for to me. Oh, God, I read it book by John White, great author, bring him to Lac La Biche. And then the Italian Roman Catholic priest, he started to pray. Everybody in the room prayed that God would send that man to our little town in Northeast Alberta, and we all said amen, and I looked at them, and I said, I just booked him. Then they said, can we share him? I said, let's do that. And so I called John White back, and all six of those churches shared the event where Dr. John White, the founder of the InterVarsity in Latin America, one of the leading figures in the evangelical movement in the 21st century, that man came to my little tiny church. And then I moved to Vancouver to be mentored by him. I went to school. And he moved to Vancouver. He was in California at the time. He was an English guy who lived in Canada and was doing some research in California when I phoned him. Mm-hmm. So he moved to Vancouver, settled there. When I moved to Vancouver to go to school. And so he said, look, I'm a busy man. You need to pray before you see me. And I have a psychiatric practice. I'm an author and I travel to about 20 nations a year. Mm-hmm. And I'm a sessional lecturer at Regent College and I don't have a lot of time, but the Lord has commanded me to mentor you. And here's what we'll do. You pray until you know that you need to see me. Then phone me and I will cancel my next day and I'll give you the day. Sherman, I did that 8 times. And every single time that I called him, he always had already canceled the day because he knew I was coming. Mm. It was an incredible thing. So I said to him, John, why did you take a phone call, a cold call from somebody that you'd never met from a little church in Northeast Alberta in a little town called Lac La Biche, which is a 3-hour drive with 2 hours over gravel? Why did you say yes to come to my little church? And he said, well, David, it was the strangest thing. I turned 60 and I was having a prayer time And in my prayer time, I said to the Lord, Father, I have completed everything I've set out to do. I have written 20 books. I have become a medical doctor. I served in World War II. I received awards for my service. I become a doctor of psychiatry. I have a practice that includes many patients. I have raised my 5 children. I have paid off my mortgage. I have a nest for all of my children to be married off and launched in life. Everything that I've set out to do in life has been accomplished. What do you want me to do? And he heard a voice. And the voice said, I want you to find a pastor. Make sure he's poor. Bear all the expenses and mentor him for a year so that he can become a writer and travel. And then when you are done with that pastor, find another one. And until you die, you will mentor one pastor a year and give him significant blocks of time. And so when I called, and then he said, what pastor should I mentor? The Lord said to him, I will tell you tomorrow. And that's when I called on the phone. And that's what he said. Oh, don't hang up. It might be Jesus. It might be Jesus, he said. So that story is in this book about listening to the voice of the Lord. Hey, are you there? It's me, God. How to listen, test, and speak. How to know when God speaks. It's a book I published. And actually, a California guy, Jack Canfield, wrote the foreword to this book. That's Chicken Soup.
Oh, I know exactly who that is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote the foreword to this book. And so he reviewed the manuscript and he did the work and so on. He loves the stories in this book. That's the third story in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. That's I wasn't expecting to go there today, but that's where I landed.
Yeah, you never know where you're going to go on the Midlist and Grind podcast. You might end up, a lot of people are just more open and free about expression and sharing stories and things like that. And that's one thing I love, because honestly, I feel like you have to be pretty vulnerable to share that, because a lot of people are going to be like, what the heck? That sounds kind of creepy.
Well, yes.
Does that really happen?
Yeah. It really happens. Yes. Yeah. So the bottom line is I had witnesses. I had the whole congregation full of witnesses who saw him. I have a picture of me and John White standing side by side. And I have pictures of me with that ministerial association.
Yeah.
Where he did come to my church in February of 1987. He spent 8 days with us. And then I was in his home in Vancouver. And he's passed away. His wife, Lori, came with him. Lori's still alive. And when John died, I called. I couldn't get to the funeral. I called and I said, oh, Lori, I'm so sorry that John has passed on. He was a great mentor to me, a great friend. And she told me how he died. This was an astonishing thing. So there was. So I was the first of, I think, 15 pastors that he mentored. And he maintained the relationship with all 15 right through till the end. He started mentoring when he was 62 and he died 15 years later, as his parents had died around the same age, somewhere between 79 and 80. Anyway, he got Alzheimer's at the end. And so I called Lori to give my sympathies for what had happened. And I said, oh, Lori, I'm so sorry I couldn't get there. And she said, well, David, let me tell you a story. John was mentoring one pastor a year. I said, oh, I know. I've met some of them. She said, yes, you didn't meet the last one. He was a pastor from Hawaii. And that pastor from Hawaii was flying into Vancouver, changing planes and flying to a conference in Toronto. And he had an 8-hour layover. I said, oh, okay. What happened with that? She said, well, he came to see us. He knocked on our door and I answered. And he said, hi, Lori, it's good to see you. Is it at all possible to visit with John? I know he's not been well. And she said, sometimes he doesn't recognize me. Sometimes he doesn't. So let's do this. He loves chocolate ice cream. And Earl Grey tea, hot, with the cover on. So she said to him, I will get the chocolate ice cream, we'll make the tea, and we'll go upstairs. If John does not recognize me, he won't recognize you. But if he's aware, he would like to see you. We'll have the ice cream, we'll have the tea, and let's see what happens. And they went upstairs. He was awake. She gave him the ice cream and tea. He enjoyed them. He sat up. He paid attention. He visited with the Hawaiian pastor about his ministry. And he said, now, I would like to pray for you. Would you allow me to do that? And that pastor said, oh, please. And he put his hand on the head of this pastor and he said, oh, God, grant this man to enter into a ministry such as he's never dreamed of before. Take some of the anointing that's upon me and place it upon him, that he might write, that he might teach, that he might travel. Amen. And then he looked up and he said, oh, my. And then he died.
He died right after that? Like
right after he prayed the prayer. His last experience was to pray a blessing on a pastor that he was mentoring.
So while he had his hands on him and released, he died. Yes,
that's what happened.
And what happened with that pastor? That's the next
question. That I've not followed through. I have not done that. But I have followed through with Lori, and she has been in touch with several of them. Almost all of them have become people who travel and write like I do. So my ministry now is no longer being a local church pastor. Mm-hmm. Now I write books, and now I travel, and now I teach. So, for example, this year, last year I was in Australia twice. I was across the United States and Canada. And this year, I just got back from five events on the lower mainland of British Columbia. You call that the Pacific Northwest. And I'm going to be traveling to Vietnam to speak to people who've been under the persecuted church. And I'm going to be going there in October. And my hope and my prayer is that I'll be able to take a book that has been translated of mine into Vietnamese and give it away at no charge to 1,700 pastors and leaders who haven't been able to receive theological education. I'll be going there in October.
Man, that is amazing. And at least you have the internet now. You could like definitely spread your message throughout the world.
Well, yeah, sure. You're in LA and I'm in Ontario. We're talking.
Yeah, exactly.
So one class I taught, I had someone from, I had two people from Australia. I had one person from India. I had five Americans from different states across the United States in three different time zones. Mm-hmm. I had representatives from three time zones in Canada. I had someone from England, someone from Nigeria, and someone from the Czech Republic. And we were all teaching together in real time on a Zoom call. It's amazing. Yeah, it's just amazing.
Wow. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Oh, wait, because that definitely could have happened in 1987.
It wouldn't have happened in 87. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I wanted to talk about healing with prayer. So we did talk previously about your wife having muscular dystrophy, right?
That's right.
Your adopted daughter having it as well. Yep. And then one got cured and one stayed the same.
That's right. Now I tell both stories in the Healing Prayer book. So if the people are on visual, it's behind me over my shoulder here. Mm-hmm. That book's been put up by Whitaker House. But let me tell you that story. I was serving a congregation just outside of Edmonton, Alberta. And for Americans who don't know, that's a city of 1.3 million about 6 hours north of the Montana border. So just Edmonton is there. And I was in a little suburb called Spruce Grove. And that church was a dynamic place, very, very focused on international mission as well as on local outreach and help and so on. And I wound up in partnership with two American congregations to help Uganda rebuild after it had been devastated by Idi Amin and Joseph Kony. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in what used to be a war zone, but it was a devastated place. I wound up going to the town of Arua, and that town was where Idi Amin kept his concubines, and he had a private airstrip there. Anyway, it was a devastated place, but it had become free. Mm-hmm. And there's a delightful, marvelous story that's attached to that freedom, and it has to do with the prayers of the saints and so on. But I met a Ugandan bishop who had organized to educate 1,000 pastors from that region. And they had not had theological education. In fact, the reality was nobody had an education. So if you could get yourself being able to read, you would become a town leader, whether you were the mayor or whether you were somebody who taught in the school or whether you were the local pastor. Their whole infrastructure had been destroyed. Mm-hmm. And so our goal was to go and help them. So the two Americans, Mike Plunkett from NIAC and Fred Hartley from Lilburn, Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, they partnered with me from Spruce Grove. And the three of us went on a three-year cycle to three different regions to give theological education to those pastors. And I took build teams with me. So we'd have people who built a library. One time they built a school building. One time they built a latrine and so on and so forth. And I would teach the pastors. And then we would do a crusade in the evenings. And then we would we'd do a build project to help them create infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so it was a marvelous thing, really. But my church spent a lot of money. And so did the other two congregations. And my elder board at the Spruce Grove Church said, we want to see this guy. Because we'd spent about $500,000 over the 3 years. Because we'd have to pay for their for the transportation, we'd have to pay for their meals, we'd have to pay for our airfares, we had to pay for the team, we had to pay for materials and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I said, well, listen, the guy's an African tribal. He talks like an African tribal. He will tell the women what to do. But you don't do that to Canadian girls. And he'll make people want him to shine his shoes and so on. And so they said, well, is he a marvelous leader? I said, he is. Is he anointed by the Holy Spirit? I said, yes, he is. They said, well, then why don't you spend 4 weeks in advance of his arrival and tell the congregation how he might behave you? And then say, oh, by the way, we're helping him rebuild North Uganda. So with great reluctance, I said yes. And in time, we flew him in. I met him in the airport and he said, David, I don't know what it is. I feel like I'm supposed to be really gentle with your congregation. Does that make sense to you? I said, oh, yes, it does. Anyway, we are having this. So it's a 3-day event. And so we have a Saturday night with our regular Saturday night service. We have a Sunday morning at 9. We have a Sunday morning at 11. We are having an evening thing over at a local church that was working with us, and then another evening thing and another. So it worked out to about 4 days. Anyway, on the Saturday night, the guy was absolutely spellbinding. He was talking about those stories where people would be awakened in the night and pray for someone and the bullet would just miss them the next day in the middle of the war zone. This kind of stuff is what he was talking about. And it was electrifying. And everybody in the Saturday night congregation texted all their friends. And then they showed up together with their friends for the 9 o'clock service. Mm-hmm. Now, ordinarily, they would spread throughout the three. But this time we had a concentration of two congregations in one. And the 9 o'clockers were so moved by this guy, they wanted to come to 11. And so it's an overpacked sanctuary. Everybody's standing room only. We got the thing spilling out into the gym, into the hallways. We have everybody sitting on the seats along the walls. And I am sitting on the steps next to the lectern because I can't, there's no room to sit down. And he's preaching. Now, my wife was afflicted with something called FSH muscular dystrophy. That means fascioscapular humeral. And the founder of Lululemon has that right now. He just made a $100 million US donation to the American Muscular Dystrophy Society to defeat this. But here's what happens with that particular affliction. Your muscles sag. If you damage a muscle, you lose it. You can't whistle because your face muscles sag. And then your shoulder blades go out of position and you're in chronic pain and you get dizzy. And if you damage a muscle, you lose it. You wind up in a wheelchair. You don't die young, but you die afflicted. So he doesn't know that my wife has that affliction, that her mother had that affliction, that her sister and her niece had that affliction. It's in the female line of the family. So I married the girl because she was the first one to laugh at my jokes. Anyway, she's sitting two rows back from the front. I am sitting on the steps looking at her and he's beside me. Mm-hmm. And while he's telling one of these amazing deliverance from death stories, one of these amazing things, he stops in the middle of it. And he looks down at me and he speaks with his thick Ugandan accent. I don't want to mock it, but I'll try and give you a sense because it was hard to understand it. He said, David, what is MA? I said, MA, Master of Arts? I don't know. He said, no, something's wrong. And he put his head in the pulpit. And there were 600, 650 people in a sanctuary designed for 400. Packed mm-hmm. to the rafters, waiting for him to finish this story that he was telling. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't finish the story. Instead, he looks up and he says this. It is a wasting muscle disease. It starts in your head. It goes down into your face. Your shoulder blades go out of position. Your spine curves. You're in chronic pain between 16 and 20. It onsets between then. And he gives a perfect medical description of FSH muscular dystrophy. And then he says this, whoever has this, Jesus has just healed you. Now, I was looking at my wife. She'd not been able to raise her arms above her shoulders like this for more than 20 years. And in front of 650 witnesses who knew her for 5 years, her arms went above her head for the first time in 20 years.
Oh, wow.
All the pain in her body vanished. And we had guests in our home because people were considering to come to Uganda. And they were friends of years who had traveled and they were staying in our home. And so after church was done, of course, I'm in absolute awe. I can hardly believe what I'm seeing because for her to go upstairs, she had to take hold of the rail and pull herself and then take her leg by her hands and put it on the next step, get herself balanced and then lift her next leg up to get herself balanced. And then she'd repeat the whole procedure. Going up 6 or 7 steps could be 20, 25 minutes. We were thinking about moving into a one-floor home because it was impossible for her to be able to go up and down those stairs. And our bathroom was upstairs. We had one step down to a local bathroom downstairs, and I put a ramp in there and had a ramp in the front. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm telling you this story. I have a medical doctor's note on this one. The doctor knew her for 5 years before this thing happened, and he waited 3 more years before he wrote the note, and I can send you the note. He was a teaching guy from the University of Alberta hospital, mm-hmm. and he had regular students with him, so he's medically savvy, very fine doctor. So we go home, and we have guests, and the plan was that I would get up on the steps to take down the pots and pans that were heavy, so she could start to cook the lunch for all the guests that we have. Mm-hmm. She pushes me aside. She steps on the steps. She takes down the heavy pots and pans on her own in front of all the people who are watching this. 1 week later, I really knew she was healed. And here's why. I have a son and a daughter. And my son is 6 years older than my daughter. And the daughter and he are inseparable friends. And for some reason, my daughter decided to be obnoxious. she was insulting her brother consistently over the breakfast table. And we were getting more and more upset with this girl. We were doing our best to try and make her not be like that. And our son was doing the valiant best that he had to make sure that he didn't respond in kind. And my wife was just about, I was just about to discipline our girl when my wife lost it. She said, "Jessica Chotka, that's enough." And she stands up, she stomps her foot, she grabs my daughter by the hand, she runs her up the stairs, she makes her go into the bedroom and make her bed and puts her toys away, stands up unaided, goes into the bathroom, brushes her teeth, runs down the stairs, puts her in the van and drives her to school. And we were so mad at our daughter, we didn't even realize she'd run up the steps unaided and that she'd knelt down beside the bed and helped her make the bed and raced into the bathroom and ran down the stairs and went into the van and drove her out without any pain. She'd not done that in the entire time that little girl was alive, that my daughter was never died. She'd not been able to do that. Jesus healed her. I watched it. My congregation watched it.
And there's no cure for this disease, is it?
It is medically impossible. There is no cure. It does not exist. And that's why the founder of Lululemon has just given $100 million to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. Because he wants to see if there's any kind of medical intervention that could happen to help people like that. And the symptoms in his case are the same. He's having trouble with his walking. He's losing his ability. He can't raise his arms above his shoulders. His face is sagging. It's the same. And the shoulder blades are out of position. Same symptoms, exactly the same symptoms. And so this happened in front of 650 witnesses. I have it recorded. And the doctor.
You have it like recorded, like as far as like visually recorded?
No, it was audio. It was an audio. We always did audio. an audio recording.
Oh, okay. Because I know it was a long time ago. So I
was... Yeah, it was February the 22nd of 2009.
It wasn't that long ago.
But, you know, listen, that's right. But it was 2009. That happened in front of 650 witnesses. Oh, my. Before that, I had to help her get out of bed. She'd have to put her arms around my shoulders and I'd have to physically lift her up to get her into the shower so that she could have a hot shower so her muscles would be limber enough for her to be able to move. The next day, she jumped out of bed and got in the shower herself. And every day when she gets up, it's a miracle. Now, her sister is afflicted with it and she hasn't been healed. Now, my son just got married in May last mm-hmm. year. And my wife's sister came. And she is declining with this muscular dystrophy and my wife as well. And when you see the two side by side, this was a miracle. It happened. It's just astonishing beyond measure. Now, I wrote the healing prayer book because I wanted to teach people about medicine, miracle, and mystery mm-hmm. intertwining.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to judge anybody who's not been healed. Neither do I want to prevent somebody from seeking prayer for healing when they're in the middle of the need for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so myself and actually the co-author is a man by the name of Maxie Dunham. He's 89 years old. He was the head of Asbury Theological Seminary. And he's written 50 books. The first co-write he did was this one. And so we start the book with two stories of miraculous healing. And in his case, it was his grandson, the son of his daughter. His daughter, Kim, has married a medical doctor. Okay, so that just put that in perspective. Mm-hmm. They had a son who was born with something called nystagmus. That means his eyes were going back and forth rapidly, and it was hard for that child to focus. And so when they took the child to the eye doctor, and of course, this is a medical doctor and wife, and she is a pastor, and so both of them have dealt with people in medical distress all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
They discover that the child has something called optic nerve hypoplasia. And that meant that the optic nerve was half the size it was supposed to be. It was very thin, and it was obviously not going to work. And the doctor told Maxie's daughter that her son was going to be blind. and it wasn't going to work. They weren't going to be able to. They're going to have the kid close to the front of the class, et cetera, et cetera. And the story is recorded by somebody married to a medical doctor. And so what happened was her husband got transferred to Hartford, Connecticut to be at a training institution for an internship. And while they were there, they brought the medical files with them of what happened with this child. And she, of course, they had to get a new eye doctor. And so she brought the file with her. They checked into an eye doctor. And the eye doctor did what eye doctors always do. They did the standard examination to see how the kid was doing. Did the little thing with the eyebrow and look inside the eye to see how it's going. And he said, oh, yes, everything's fine. And he said that there was no optic nerve hypoplasia. It was gone. And so Kim looked at the doc and said, wait a minute, I'm married to a medical doctor. Here's the file from the last doctor. And those two doctors knew each other.
Oh, yeah.
And so he looked at the file and said, well, this can't be. This has to be an error. This child does not have optic nerve hypoplasia. There was about 5% of the nystagmus left, but none of the optic nerve hypoplasia. And the thing that caused sweetness to come to Maxie Dunham's faith, that son, Nathan, got married a year ago and has just had a child. And there's no trace of any kind of eye issue at all. And what happened was Maxie, my co-author, got all kinds of people praying for that child, and he became well. So that's one of the first stories in the book. So we set the stage by telling stories about how people receive miraculous healing. And then we grapple with the issue of when the healing doesn't come. And so we talk about holy mystery. And we also talk, actually, we talk about five pathways to healing. One is the instant heal. And I just told you a story, two stories of that. The second is a pathway to a remedy, where God guides you to somebody who's done 20, 25 years of research. And the next thing you know, you're into the care of somebody who has amazing skill. And they're able to bring you to a place where you receive a therapy or an adaptive behavior or a medicine that heals you, et cetera. The third is natural healing. Now, I didn't used to think that was a category at all. But I'll tell you something. Before my wife was healed, if she damaged a muscle, she lost it. After she was healed, muscle tissue grew. That's a miracle.
Right.
So natural healing can be a miracle. Then there's these seasons where we suffer and we don't know why. And I we call that holy mystery. And last of all, everybody's got an appointed time. And we talk about the majestic crossing at the end of your life. So these are five pathways that are ordinary for people who are looking for healing prayer. The instant heal, natural healing, pathway to a remedy, bearing with suffering, and finally the miraculous crossing at the end of your life. And all five of those intertwine. They overlap each other, they intertwine. And I myself was miraculously cured of a paralyzed face. I had something called Ramsey-Hunt syndrome. And I have a medical doctor's note for that one too. That means I had a shingles infection in my left ear and it paralyzed my face from the corner of my eyebrow down to the top of my face. Now, Justin Bieber had this in his 20s. And if in your 20s, you have a really good chance of recovery. And of course, I'm sure he got the best medicine that America could offer. By the way, Justin Bieber's
also. He's a Canadian.
He's a Canadian. I mean, married an American. So there you go. Anyway, getting back to this, he did experience the best of medical care. He's also a Christian believer. I don't know if you know that.
Just yeah.
He is. Anyway, of course, so he had Ramsey-Hunt. And the ordinary trajectory for Ramsey-Hunt, in your 20s, you have a really good shot at recovering. If you are in your 30s, you got a 50-50 shot. If you're in your 40s, you're going to get 10, 15% of your face back. If in your 50s, you're not going to recover. Your face is going to be paralyzed. And my face was paralyzed when I was 53. So my doc said, you're not going to get better. The ordinary trajectory for this is 2 or 3 days, you get put on an antiviral and a steroid. And if you're beyond that, the odds are you're not going to get recovered. And I didn't get treated for that because there was a misdiagnosis when I first went in. I didn't get treated until 8 days in. And so he said, it's like giving you water. But in case you're one of these tough guys, I'm going to give you the meds. And nothing happened. I received no improvement at all until a Tuesday when the medicine ran out. And I remember the moment I cried out to God and I said, it's over. I'm not going to be able to speak. Actually, I said, I can't speak. I'm not going to be able to preach. I'm not going to be able to say anything to visit someone. And I've been a pastor from the time I was 23 until I was 53. I mean, what are you going to do with your life?
Right.
All of your life has been trained around this one thing.
Right.
And there was a series of people who started to pray for me. And here's where the miracle moment happened. There was a lady named Gail. She was a great friend of my wife's. And she and a couple of friends came over on a Friday night. And they came to pray for me. Of course, my elders had come to pray for me. And there'd been a Pentecostal pastor who came to pray for me. And the church was praying for me, et cetera, et cetera. But nothing happened. And on the Friday night, just about 2 weeks after I was afflicted with this, this lady, Gail, comes by and she said, I have felt compelled to fast and pray for you. And so I said, well, thank you, Gail, thank you very much. And she said, yes, the enemy has taken advantage. But you must, like the Apostle Paul, when he suffered shipwrecked in the last couple of chapters of the Acts of the Apostles, he was shipwrecked on shore. He picked up a piece of wood to throw in a fire and a snake latched onto his wrist. He shook the snake off and he was made well. And so she said, you must, like the apostle had a snake on the wrist, the enemy has taken advantage, but you must shake this off. And when you do, this will be testimony to the world that Jesus is the healer. And so I heard that. My face didn't change. That was Friday night. And on Sunday morning, I was unable to speak still. My wife looked at me and she said, look, my cousin David has a church 2 hours drive south. Let's go and see him. We've never been able to visit him on a Sunday because you're always preaching. Let's go 2 hours south. We'll visit my cousin David. You sleep in the car while I drive. I said, okay. We get to the church. His pastor's name was David Larson. He says to me, David, what happened to you? I said, no, I answered as best I could with my paralyzed face. He said, well, listen, can we pray for you at the end of the service? I said, sure. So at the end of the service, he stands up and he says, my cousin's husband is here. He's a pastor. He has been seriously afflicted with this thing called Ramsey Hunt. We're going to come up to the front and we're going to have prayer for him. Mm-hmm. So I go to the front. There's five or six people gathered around. It's a country church. And in walks a lady late. And I have my eyes open. I see this lady walk in late. She sits down in the back row. They start to pray and she stands up. And she says this. The enemy has taken advantage. You must shake this off. And when you do, the Lord will use this as the platform to declare that Jesus is the healer all over the earth. It was exactly the same thing that my wife's friend Gail had said mm-hmm. on the Friday night. And I was in a church that I'd never been to before. And that lady did not know me. She said exactly the same thing. Well, the following Tuesday morning, I wake up. My face is still paralyzed. The medicine was gone. And I said, God, I have no hope. The only thing I can do is trust in you and believe in you. And there was a scripture that I'd been reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 5. And it was the story of a man who'd been 38 years sick, lying beside a pool of water, where all the sick people in Jerusalem would come. It's called the Pool of Bethesda. And Jesus asked this man, do you want to be made well? And he says, I want to get in the water. And the Lord says, pick up your bed and walk. And then after he's healed, he says, you have been made well. Now go and sin no more so nothing worse comes upon you. And that scripture, every time I thought of it, caused fire and peace come into my spirit. And on the Tuesday, I said this thing and I went to bed. I was sleeping 10 to 16 hours a day. Mm-hmm. I woke up for supper and I felt tingling in the corner of my eye. It was like an hour after the dentist. And I tried to call my wife and she said, oh, yes, dear. I said, come there. And I was able to move my eyebrow like a fraction of an inch. She said, yes, dear. Now go to sleep. So she didn't see any change. The next day I woke up, no change. I go through the day, 7:30 that night. My eyebrow starts to tingle like an hour after the dentist. Mm-hmm. And this time I'm able to open and shut my eye for the first time in almost a month. And I call my wife and she said, something's happening. And every night for the next seven consecutive nights, it was like an hour after the dentist and more of my face came back. And I was booked in to see my doctor a week later. So I go to see him. I sit down in the doctor's office and he said, David, how you doing? And I went like this. Fine, doc. How about you?
Oh, wow. Said,
you moved your face. That's medically impossible. You can't do that. You have Ramsey Hunt. And I said, I know it's medically impossible. And I said, do you want to move the other eyebrow? And I did the Vulcan live long and prosper and raise my eyebrow. I'm a Star Trek fan. So
yeah.
And then I was able to, I have this little trick under as a kid where I can make my nostrils go in and out. I did that. And my wife gave me the elbow. She said, David Chotkin, that's rude. Stop doing that. And the doctor said, you shouldn't be able to do that. I was going to give you a doctor's letter so you could get career counseling, so you could change your profession. My goal in seeing you today was not to do anything other than to help you find some sort of way to alleviate your trouble and to give you whatever medical information you needed to get retrained. I said, yes, doc, I do believe that I've been made well. He said, well, how did it happen? And I told him. I said, I do believe that the Lord has made me well. And he looked at me and he sat back in his chair and he said, look, my wife's a real Catholic. I'm not. I don't even pretend. She's a real believer. I'm not. And then he said this. I have lots of people who come to see me all the time. People of faith from every description. And they all want to say that their God has healed them. And it's usually the placebo effect. In your case, and by the way, in your wife's case with the muscular dystrophy a few years back, I am prepared to say that something beyond medical science has happened. And I have that doctor's note too. Jesus healed me in front of my congregation. It was the most amazing, incredible thing. So I want to teach people about how healing prayer works. And that's why I wrote Healing Prayer with Maxie Dunham, whose grandson was healed. And we tease out implications of what it looks like. And by the way, we don't shortchange suffering. There are seasons where people suffer and die, even when you do pray with them.
Yeah.
We deal with the holy mystery. We deal with, I'm not one of these guys who says, suck it up, you're going to be fine, and keep speaking what you need to speak. I don't do that. What I do is we cooperate with the presence. And when we become aware of an increase of the Lord's presence, we partner with that. And while we're in the middle of that, amazing and astonishing things occur.
Mm-hmm.
So we teach people how to pay attention to that. That's what the book's about. It's called Healing Prayer, God's Idea for Restoring Body, Mind, and Spirit. Put up by Whitaker House. Put out last November, 23. And in fact, I just finished recording 15 videos. And those videos are going to be released in June.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be available to teach people the 15, 10, 7 to 10 minute videos that will be attached to the purchase of the book. So that small groups or churches can use them to mentor their congregational members on how to develop a healing prayer team to give care to people who are in distress when they come to worship.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. And I like how you said that you don't make it seem like everybody that does that is going to get healed. Because that's often.
No, my daughter's not. You're quite right. Yeah. My daughter's not been healed. Yes.
Yeah, it's like the duality of it, because you could pray for the best, but then you also have to be prepared for the worst.
That's completely true. You are completely correct.
There is such thing as a worse, but you know, it just depends on the perspective.
that's true. But I don't want to shortchange anyone's suffering. The reality is that there are people who are in the middle of needless despair and they don't know why.
Right.
I do not want to make it worse by banging them over a head with a club and saying, oh, by the way, you got to stick to whatever you did. You got to repent of some sin issue. I'm not going to say that to somebody. Right. Jesus didn't say that to anybody. He did say sometimes there's a connection. And you know this, if somebody smokes to beat the band and they get lung cancer, well, there's a cause for it. Oh, by the way, if you're sexually promiscuous and you get an STD, you're going to get an STD because you're sexually promiscuous. Mm-hmm. Let's not shortchange the fact that some behaviors lead to bad health.
Right.
Workplace things happen like this. My mom and dad ran a restaurant. They were always inhaling secondhand smoke. My mom got cancer when she was up in years. I know exactly where she got it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's a direct link between what you do and your work or some sin pattern that's in your life. But that's not the center of what the gospel says about prayer for healing.
Mm-hmm.
What the gospel says about prayer for healing is that Jesus himself is the healer. And if somebody's afflicted or somebody's in trouble, he comes alongside them to teach and lead them. Mm-hmm. Not to make them worse. And I want to teach how to do that in that book. That's what Maxie and I have decided to do.
Well, I was reading the Bible yesterday, and well, not yesterday, last week. And Jesus' disciples were basically saying, like, how are you able to help cure people and aid people and things like that? And he said, the reason why you're not able to do it is because you lack faith.
Oh, that's in Mark chapter 9. I know that story.
Yeah.
It's Mark chapter. That's not quite correct. Here's what happens. He goes up on the Mount of Transfiguration and he spends 3 days or four, and he's got the three disciples with him. Uh-huh. He's praying, he's fasting, and he's transfigured before them, and they're astonished and in awe. And the other nine guys are down in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a dad who brings an epileptic boy to the nine disciples. Mm-hmm. And they believe that there's an unclean spirit behind it. They're unable to cast the thing out. Mm-hmm. And they're bothered because they have healed and they've cast out demons before.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus comes down from the mountain. He sees the dad, and the boy goes into an epileptic seizure, starts to roll on the ground, And Jesus looks at the dad and says, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, since childhood. It throws him in the water. It throws him in the fire. And then in the course of time, the man says this very famous phrase. And so the man who's brought his son to these nine apostles and they haven't been able to fix it. Jesus says, all things are possible to those who believe. Yep. And he says, I do believe. Help my unbelief. And it's very clear that he has already acted out of faith by bringing that boy to those nine apostles, and it didn't work. So his faith is wounded. Mm-hmm. Jesus does not tell him off. Instead, he deals with the affliction. He casts the unclean spirit out. And then in Mark chapter 9, there's a parallel passage in Matthew as well. So in Mark chapter 9, that's the one I'm working from. Mm-hmm. He takes him into a private place, and they say to him, how come we couldn't do that?
Yeah.
You trained us. You showed us. We've had previous success. How come we couldn't do that? Mm-hmm. And he says this very interesting thing. He says, this kind of demon does not come out except by prayer and fasting. Now, he had just been praying up on the mountain. Mm-hmm. He had just been fasting. And when he came down, that means that there are categories of things that have different ways of responding to them. And the Matthew parallel talks about faith as well. And so I don't want to just one-off this thing and say, oh, by the way, it's only this. But what I want to tell you is that in the gospel tradition, each healing is different. Mm-hmm. Each one has a different root. Each one has a different effect. Each one is a different application. And what I do in the Healing Prayer Book with Maxie Dunham, the co-writer, is to walk through pitfalls to avoid, to walk through different approaches, to walk through spiritual preparation to get yourself ready to be part of a healing prayer team, to talk about how you manage this, to talk about stories of faith where there's miraculous healing, and to acknowledge the fact that from time to time you pray into holy mystery and you have not a clue what's going to happen next. And each account, each story, each encounter is always very different from the last. In fact, you do not see Jesus of Nazareth repeating the method that he uses in the previous healing anywhere in the gospel tradition. They're all different. They all depend on being present to the manifest presence of God. He actually says this in John's gospel. Right after the man is healed by the pool of Bethesda, he says, I can do nothing unless the Father shows me. In other words, he would have a prayer life that would give him a download about what he was supposed to do in real time. And he would enter into the download to pray the way that he was seeing the Father's action on the person he was praying for. We teach people how to do that in this book.
Hmm. Wow. I'm glad I brought that up. Yeah, because I feel like some of the gospels, like you said, they parallel each other. So, yeah.
Definitely. They do. Well, actually, so if you're doing New Testament studies, there's a thing called the synoptic problem. And I'll just tell you what it is. The Gospel of Mark, 90% of it has been reproduced in Matthew and Luke. Mm-hmm. So it's very clear that the Gospel of Mark was the first gospel written. And Luke admits it at the beginning of Luke's gospel. He says, oh, by the way, I wasn't an eyewitness. And oh, by the way, I've compiled an orderly account. And oh, by the way, I interviewed eyewitnesses. And oh, by the way, I've incorporated other people's writings. And so what you have going on here is the writer of Luke and the writer of Matthew used Mark. Mm. And they built that in to the writing of their gospel because it was a track record of what had already happened. And actually, I'm writing a book on Mark right now. And I'm quite convinced that Mark was written by Simon Peter, his son. I think Peter got killed by Nero. He was executed, hung upside down. Mm-hmm. And Mark, who was his son, called John Mark in other places in the gospel, didn't want to lose his daddy's preaching. And so he reduced it to writing. But I'll tell you something. It's rough grammar. I'm a Greek scholar. The word immediately shows up 88 times in 16 chapters. and immediately. It's very clear. That boy spoke some other language and he was using translation Greek to translate that for the Roman church that he was writing to. Anyway, Luke, you read him. He takes all the rough grammar in Mark and smooths it out and turns it into a beautiful narrative. Mm-hmm. And so it's very clear that Mark came first because Luke picks it up and it's the same account, but it's much smoother. So you put these three things together. It's very clear. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are codependent on each other. John is an entirely different source altogether. Mm-hmm. So this is a lecture here on New Testament origins, what I'm giving you right now. But I don't know if that doesn't impact what happens with our faith. what happens with our faith is that we take it as received tradition, we take it as the word of the Lord, and we take it as the guide to direct us into how to understand the mind of Christ, because they are faithful witnesses to the life of Jesus.
Right. Wow. And I also read the book of Thomas, the book of Judas, the book of Mary, that were actually outside of the Bible, and those were pretty harsh. I was like, ooh, wee.
There's a reason why they're called the Gnostic Gospels and the Apocrypha. They're not included because they are harsh.
It's like,
they don't conform to the same stuff that you had going on in the four Gospels. It's not the same kind of Jesus.
No, it's like
actually, they date from about 200 or 300 years after those Gospels were written. What I can say to you is that there's about 5,000 extant manuscripts of the New Testament as you and I have received it, about 5,000. There's also early translations in Syriac and in Coptic, Egyptian, and so on. And we have fragments of the Gospels that date back to as early as the lifetime of John, the son of Zebedee, one of the apostles. Written around AD 90, around 100, he died in 90. So you have copies. There's a little fragment of the Gospel of John that was found inside the coffin of somebody in Egypt.
What?
And it was preserved inside the wrap where somebody was obviously Christian. And that sarcophagus dates to about 125 AD. And the fact that there is a fragment of John's Gospel inside that Egyptian mummy says that that Gospel circulated and got as far as Egypt by 125 AD.
Wow.
So you don't have anything like that with the Gnostic Gospels, nothing like that at all.
Wow.
What I encourage you people to do, there are good books on this, and there's a course that help people to understand this. So if anyone wants to take Alpha, you will hear one of the finest text critics in the world talk about the documentary tradition. And so there's only one copy of Julius Caesar's work. There's only one copy of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. There's 5,000 extant manuscripts of the New Testament, with a whole bunch of them dating from around the beginning of the first or second century.
Mm-hmm.
No other ancient writing has anything that comes close to that.
Hmm. Wow. And that's amazing, because like you said, translation is something else too. Like translating one word for the next word will give the passage a total different meaning than what it was intended to be.
That's quite true. Yeah. Now here's a wrap. So actually I can tell you this. We have a key to this. So 150 years before Jesus arrived, a bunch of Hebrew scholars, and they called them the 70 as a Septuagint, translated the Hebrew scriptures into current Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have something called the Septuagint, which means the 70, translating the Hebrew manuscripts that were around then. And so we have in front of us the ability to look at how those translators 150 years before Jesus managed Hebrew going into Greek.
Mm.
So that's available for anybody who wants it. And this is ordinary scholarship. It's not hard to find this. You can just Google this and you'll find out. It's called the L2X is the Septuagint. And you can read that history for yourself if you want to look that up. Mm. But what it means is we have a living example of what people who were alive 150 years before Jesus did to translate Hebrew into Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And the passages are parallel. So we can see how they manage the material. And that helps us in our study.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It has to. One thing that our research is, it's kind of funny because adultery means something different in Hebrew than what it does in English. And adultery in Hebrew was that a man could not have sex with another man's wife. And for women, it's like a woman can have sex with almost... I think with another guy, period, if she's married.
I'm gonna have to look that up. I don't,
yeah,
I
like, to, I'll, and I
if
was
I,
just
if
like,
I comment but, on that, I'm gonna say yeah, something,
but
wrong.
It sounds like that could be true, because for any man, that would make sense. Like, if you're a married woman, you can't
you
have
know what? If I told you that I'm going to have to do, before I talk, I will only speak on what I know. So I don't know what you just said. That's new to me. Mm-hmm. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was just doing research on that, and I was just like, wow, because like there's a big talk about polygamy and things like that. And so I was just like, let me figure out what the root of it is and what these things mean. And then I stumbled across that. I was like, wow. But then when I think about it, I'm like, back in those times, that makes sense. Of course, a man in power in those times will not want his wife to have sex with anybody else, but he will want to have sex with single women and period. You know what I mean? So it kind of makes sense to me.
It's a sordid history, and it's an awful history. You're quite right. I don't want to sanction that by any way, shape, or form in any part of my imagination at all, or anybody else's imagination. Yeah. I do believe that the Lord Jesus dignified the role of woman.
Yeah.
You see him elevating women. The first witnesses to the resurrection were female.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the people who supported his the primary people who supported his ministry were women.
Yeah. And so, go ahead. Oh, but then I also know that there's a difference between like culture and then religion as well, and that's another thing that I got from it, because it's
my
like,
friend, that's a whole different podcast. We get into that, we're not going to talk about anything else.
right, but you know, it's just pretty interesting, because I was just like, wow, there's a difference between culture and the word.
And, well, sure, and here, yeah. I'll just tell you that the great heresy for Western churches is to assume that the culture that you're in gets baptized by the culture of the scripture, and you produce this weird hybrid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm looking for principles that work not only in America, but in rural regions of Pakistan and in tribal societies in Africa and among people who are at the base of Latin America. I'm looking for principles that are transcultural.
Right.
When I hear somebody teaching about an aspect of the gospel that works in America, but doesn't work in England, mm-hmm. or that works in England, but doesn't work in tribal society Africa, I don't think that we're being fair to the biblical principle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking for the biblical principle that transcends culture. That's the ones that I'm going to teach.
Yeah. Yeah. And I could definitely agree to that, because I grew up with my mom being Christian, my dad involved in Islam, and he was a Black Muslim, like Malcolm X and stuff like that. Yeah. But then mm-hmm. the Orthodox Muslims from the Middle East are totally different. And the way they go through off life in Islam is totally different. And so
actually, that first church I was in had Muslims in that town. So when I moved to that little town, Lakhlabish, that I told you about,
mm-hmm.
there was a Muslim mosque in that town.
Mm-hmm.
They were 11, but they were old world Muslims. They were Lebanese Sunnis who had moved to that town because they wanted to establish a presence in Canada. The land was free, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there from a long time before. They had a Muslim mosque in that town from 1948 or something.
Wow.
Long before the conversation was happening inside Canada and the U.S. They were Muslims.
For sure.
So yeah. I wound up having this. So that's where I learned about Islam, actually. Mm-hmm. I learned about Islam by spending time with people in that little town. Mm-hmm. And they were great merchants. They were the ones who would buy and sell. And they would. And actually, it was a fascinating kind of a place to live. Because mm-hmm. in that little town, there were people right from Lebanon who had Muslim faith. There was one guy who was Syrian, who was Eastern Orthodox, and they didn't talk to each other. And there were original settlers, descendants of original settlers who'd moved to that area way back when the time when Canada was founded. They were for the most part French Catholics. There were Eastern Orthodox Ukrainians, and they fit there because that was my background. Wow. And then we had Native spirituality, and we had Métis and Métis people, have people who call themselves Métis and Métis. Mm-hmm. And the Métis were the ones who'd married the French and had children. And the mm-hmm. Métis were the ones who'd married English and had children. And Métis is French for mixed.
Oh, wow.
And they didn't talk to each other. You know, so it was the funniest thing. So that's my first. When you go to Western Canada, you expect what I call monocultural based upon immigration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the small towns in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta, they would be small towns where somebody came from one particular ethnic, and they'd set up their town, they'd get the free land and get their friends and relatives from overseas to come, and they'd reform their town.
Mm-hmm.
So you have German towns, and you have Danish towns, and you have Dutch towns, and you have Ukrainian towns. This town, Lakhlabish, had six ethnics in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. It was a great way to get started in the ministry, where you learn about different people's culture and backgrounds from a sympathetic. So I had a Métis church. I had people who were part Cree and part English.
Wow.
And yeah. So I had a Métis church, I had a Scandinavian farming church, and I had a white middle class church. And oh man, were they different.
You know, yeah, culture does like shape like how society, like I've been to a white church, I grew up in a Black church, I went to a Middle Eastern mosque and Buddhist temple, a guy from India that was ran by people from India. And I was just like, wow, all of this is like totally different.
You know? go ahead, finish your point, then I'll make it.
Oh, but and a lot of the dogmatic wars are based off of like cultural differences.
Yes. And yeah. So Christian will fight Christian and Muslim will fight Muslim. And yeah. There's no good reason for it. It's not to do with the Bible or their faith. It has to do with the fact that you have that land and I want it. That kind of thing. But so getting back to this. So on a Sunday, I had this white middle-class congregation in Lac La Biche, and I drove about 30 miles to a Scandinavian farming community with Norwegians and Finns. And then from there, I went to the Métis church that was in a little town called Kikino, which means my home in Cree. And I'd use the same sermon because I didn't have time to write more of them. And when I was in the white middle-class church that was perky, they were well-dressed, they would clap their hands, they would wave their hands around, they do a little dance when they sang. When I went to the Scandinavian farming community, they wanted a liturgical expression. They would look at me as I did the liturgy. And then when I get the car and I drive to the Métis church, they would sit in a circle. And I would, if I stood up, they would, the adults would stand up. If I sat down, the adults would sit down. And the kids were in the middle. And if I'd preach in the white church, I would preach from the front and there'd be interaction. I'd talk to people. When I preach in the Scandinavian farming town, they'd look at me. And in the Métis church, in the middle of the message, they'd say, Pastor, I want to testify. So you'd let them testify in the middle of your message. And then we'd all have a chicken dinner. What a difference. That was every Sunday of my life. Yeah. For my first 5 years in the ministry. A wonderful opportunity to discover new cultures and new people.
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the things like I loved about the Gospels is that Jesus also said, judge lest ye not be judged, I think.
Yeah, judge not so that you don't be judged.
That's judge not so you won't be judged. I'm saying
that's right.
The King James Version, my
bad. It talks about the log in your eye when you're trying to take the speck out of somebody else's.
Yeah, speck out of your own eye.
The log, it's a log in your eye. You get the speck in the other guy.
Right. And it basically teaches us that we all have faults. We all fall. You could always look at somebody and pick out a scenario of when they fell short.
Sure.
And that also helped me be able to accept more cultures. Like I live in a very diverse neighborhood and it's Persian, the Persian New Year. And I'm saying Happy New Year to my Persian friends.
But, sure. That's called good wishes. Well, I'll tell you this. The gospel does this teach this. That you're supposed to love each other.
Yeah.
How about that? Yeah. You're supposed to respect each other. How about that?
Yeah.
You're not supposed to hurt the guy next door. You're supposed to pray for him and bless him. And when they're sick, you show up with food.
Right. Treat your neighbor as you would treat yourself.
It actually says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Oh,
in other words,
have them do unto you.
Yes. So do unto this. That's actually the teaching of Jesus. He says this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In other words, if you're going to treat them poorly, then you're not you're not following Jesus at all.
Right.
That you don't believe in Jesus. That Jesus himself said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Now, you want them to be kind to you.
Right.
You want them to be generous to you.
Right.
You want them to be fair with you.
Right.
You want them to pay you when you do your work. You want them to talk nicely about you behind your back. So the whole center, that's actually one of the most important sayings of Jesus. It's called the Golden Rule.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the top commandments, I think he said.
That's the center. I think that's one of the centers of the New Testament. I really do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that makes total sense. And then I also say I wrote a book called From Grit to Greatness, Harnessing the Five Pillars of the Militant Grind. Right. And we talk about the first pillar is love. And I also say in the book, in order for you to love others how you would like to be loved, you have to love yourself.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now the bottom line is we have a lot to learn.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't stop.
No. Most people don't treat themselves the way they should.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most people hurt themselves.
Yeah. Intentionally, unintentionally, too.
I mean, if you know how to love yourself, how are you going to love someone else?
Right.
But the bottom line is I learn how to love myself by showing care for people next door to me.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of doing that, there's this thing called reciprocity. It boomerangs back.
The law of reciprocity. Yeah.
It creates community. That's what it does.
Yeah.
It does do that.
Yep. Took me a while to learn that because America is dog eat dog. Well, in the United States, you're in America too, but.
Well, North America. And there's South America. Right. Don't forget those boys. Right.
Because we're the middle of Americans, right?
But you're in the middle of North America. South America is a whole lot more. There's more people in South America than there is in North.
Right. Right. And now here it's like you race to be dog eat dog, us versus them, and this team versus that team, and us, and who's going to be the best? Pin them against each other. Yes. And it takes a while for most of us to get out of that. That's we true. Often grow up looking at the faults of someone else, not their like true value and what they could bring. Because like people
sadly,
say,
you're right.
Yeah, people say, oh my God, I love Mexican food, but deport all the Mexicans back to Mexico. And it's like, well, how are we going to get the Mexican food if we do that? So it's kind of funny, man.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah, this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm definitely going to start praying more and looking internally at all of my problems and things that I have to work out. And I'm not like new to the miracles that you stated. My mother was just in the hospital in ICU, and I come from a very, you know, hardcore Christian family, and about 30 people in a group message. Everybody was praying. Everybody came and supported. I went to her and I prayed for her as well. And I touched her and gave her my good intentions. And when I touched her, she like woke up and she just like tried to reach out for me and do all of these things. And I was just like, my sister was looking like, what? Because she was sedated. When I walked in there, she was sedated. Then I walked up to her bed. She was like, she rose up from the dead almost. And so,
you know,
I'm thinking,
you put your finger on something real important here.
Yeah.
Human touch.
Oh,
so,
yeah. With so intentions.
Intentions. Now, listen, everybody touches everybody else. And sometimes the touch is not good. But in the Gospels, the word for touch is hapto.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at its use, it's primarily found in Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And with the exception of Jesus blessing the children when he holds them,
mm-hmm.
it refers to the transfer of healing power from Jesus towards somebody who is being touched.
Yep.
Or a request for the person who is praying to touch Jesus for the transfer of healing power.
Mm-hmm.
That word is almost exclusively a healing word.
Touch. Mm. Yeah.
It's a profound thing. And you know this, that you if you squeeze somebody's elbow when they're in distress, they settle.
Yeah.
If you hug someone who is yearning for compassion, they hug in return, and the touch itself conveys a measure of healing on the level of the emotion and the body.
Yeah.
But when you're infilled by the power of Jesus' spirit,
mm-hmm.
it becomes the conduit through which the power flows.
Wow. That's amazing, because like after that, a few days after, she didn't even know that I was in the hospital.
Doesn't matter. What happened was
she
something...
was like, you came, you were there. And she was like trying to write, like she was trying to communicate with me through her fingers, like, I love you. And like trying to talk, trying to raise up. And I was just like, so you don't remember that at all whatsoever? Like,
well, no, listen, do you have kids? Are you married?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have
okay,
four
kids.
This,
you'll go into your kid's room and you'll put your hand on that child when it's sleeping.
Oh, yeah.
And that child will respond to your touch.
Yeah.
And not remember that you were there, but will be assured inside his or her little body that something good happened.
Yeah, yeah.
So they don't have like, to have
it. Yeah. When they come up to me crying, all they want is love. And I'm like,
that's
okay,
it.
Come on, let's get this over with. Come here, y'all, rub
your
back.
It's the touch that heals them. That's exactly right.
Yeah,
so
and I learned.
I think you need to read my book. You do. So we're talking about how healing happens.
Yeah.
And one of the principal instruments through which healing happens is this thing called human touch.
Yeah.
Now, you have to be careful. If you have an abuse victim, you don't touch an abuse victim unless they tell you you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be very conscious of that. And so there's mm-hmm. been times where I did a mission to Mexico. We had a number of people who went with us, and we were praying for all international workers. And there was a significant moment. There were, I think, 6 men and 5 women, something like this, on the team. And we had a lady who came into our prayer circle. And our usual go-to response was to come up, put our hand on them, give them a hello, hug them, and that kind of thing. All the men at once knew they were not to touch this woman. And all the women knew at once they were supposed to be a buffer around her. And so we said, I said to her, I feel like I'm not even supposed to touch you. She said, there was a pastor who abused me, a man. And I don't want a man to touch me for my healing. Could you please have the ladies just pray for me?
Oh, my God.
And we knew, but all of us in the room knew.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ladies formed a circle around her. She allowed us to put our hands on top of the ones who were praying for her. And as a result of that prayer time, her leg was healed. And everywhere in Mexico City, those international workers would walk. And she became quite well as a result of the healing prayer time.
So
but there
you
was
guys,
this warning. It was a warning that was given to guys. Don't touch her. Mm-hmm. She's been violated. Don't touch her. That'll hurt her. And you can cross the zone when you're not supposed to.
Right.
If you do not engage with the person you're about to intercede for or touch or bless. You have to make sure that when you're offering care, it's by permission and not by invasion.
Right. Right.
It's an important principle.
Yeah, and you definitely don't want everybody touching you. Like, get off of me. You know, and I talk to spiritual people and they say you have to be careful about who touches your hair, who touches your body, who you can, because that could also transfer bad energy or demonic forces or demonic spirits, a lot of stuff that they call it. And so I'm very careful about who touches me or engages with me, period. And sometimes you have to cleanse yourself after people touch you. And my uncle, he'll do like a spiritual ceremony before anyone enters his house. He'll get the sage and burn the sage around them to get all of the negative energy out. It kind of reminded me of I'm not sure what book in the Bible it is, but one of the books of Moses. And it says that if you take this lamb's blood and put it on your door, the spirit won't come into your home.
That was the spirit of death. That's the anchor text for all of Judaism.
Yeah.
That is the Passover. It's from Exodus. And you take the blood of the lamb and you put it over the doorpost and the lintels, and the spirit of death that was judging the Egyptians would pass over.
Right.
That is the center of Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes. you can't let these energies and these forces enter your home. Yeah. And so I would like go around my house and I'll pray and I'll say good intentions and things like that, because there was a time where my daughter was like, these monsters and this and this. And I was like, okay, I know what this is. And so I just did what I do, walked around, said my good intentions, prayers, telling the entities to get out, or bad energy or whatever people wants to call it, because I believe that that stuff is real.
Well, listen, I came to faith in Jesus when a demon was cast out of me by an English Methodist preacher. And so that's how I started in the gospel. Actually, right now I'm doing, for my own devotions, I am translating the Gospel of Mark from Greek to English. And the thing that I have discovered that is astonishing to me is how frequently Jesus casts out evil spirits. It's the he has, in Mark chapter 1, the first thing that happens to him is he gets baptized by John the Baptist. The second thing that happens is the heavens are split open and he hears the voice saying, this is my beloved son and you are well pleased. The third thing he does, he calls four disciples who are fishermen. And the fifth thing and the first public thing he does is to go into a synagogue to preach, and a man with a demon screams. He casts the unclean spirit out. And as a result, the entire synagogue starts telling everybody that this guy's got amazing power. And so all the way through the Gospel of Mark, from chapter 1 right through to chapter 9, he's consistently and regularly taking authority against demonic energy, against unclean spirit beings, against the powers and principalities. And that is the thing that characterized his ministry. And when he calls the 12 to himself, he spends the night in prayer, and he calls the 12 apostles. He calls them to himself for three purposes. Number one, that they might be with him, i.e. have a prayer life. Number two, that they might have, they might be able to preach. And number three, that they might have authority to cast out demons. That's how that gospel starts. And the whole of Jesus' ministry was characterized by the very thing you just described.
Yeah. Wow. I guess I got to start. No, I'm just playing.
Sherman, it's been, I think you need to get my book, Healing Prayer, and read through it.
Yeah. Is it on Amazon?
Yeah, you can get it on Amazon, or you actually anywhere a bricks and mortar store would have it to you. You just take the title. You can go to Walmart. You can go to Amazon. You can go to Books a Million. You can go to Barnes and Noble. You can say, I want Healing Prayer by David Chotka and Maxie Dunham, and they'll be able to order it for you.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to read it, because I figured that out when like something happens to one of my kids and I'll put my hand on their chest and I'll just put the intentions and all that, and I'll touch them gently, and next thing you know, they calm down like...
There's something special with a bond between a father and a daughter, or father and a son. It's very something very special. And under God's ordinance, he has ordained that you be the shepherd of their souls until they come to their own age of majority.
Right.
So it makes perfect sense to me that you should touch them and they should feel peace. It makes perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then even like looking at them and seeing through the human form, I say, if my son will fall and he's looking at me, and I'll like tell his spirit, get up, you're okay. And he just gets up. And I've learned that you could actually have an intention to connect with somebody through the spirit rather than just talking to them or whatever. And I remember this, like I was out to, I went out to eat and there was this guy that was homeless. He was smoking in front of like the place where I was eating at. And the security guard had a problem, but he kept coming back. Then he got in front of me and I looked at him and I was like, I just did like something and he just nodded. He was like, okay. Then he went away from the tables while he was smoking. And I was like, so my intention, I wasn't connecting with him. I was connecting with his spirit. And I told his spirit, hey, we're trying to eat here, bro. Come on. Like,
we got to do another interview. Because this is a whole different category we're talking about here.
Yeah.
I'm writing a book on Jesus' authority over the demons. It's not done. I'm going to be writing it over the next month. I've got to be teaching of it in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, at a church that's asked me to do that. But I have to get the manuscript prepared to do that. So I have a first draft. It's not done yet. But I would love to come back and talk to you about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because I'm also learning that King Solomon also had authority over demons as well.
Well, that's in the apocryphal books. It's not, what you're doing right now is you're introducing a whole new subject for a conversation.
Okay. Yeah. I also have the apocrypha. Trust me, I'm into it. But then I've also learned that there's things like beyond the Bible that we could research, that we could learn. And yeah,
that might be true. No, Chris, I will restrict myself to what I know.
Right. Yeah.
So I do know the scripture. So if I was to talk to you, and I'm aware of some of the things you're talking about, mm-hmm. and I have some expertise in some of the things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. But the best thing that I can do to be faithful to and helpful to your audience is to talk about what I do know.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. No, we could definitely do another episode on that. I would definitely, okay. Yeah.
Well, listen, here's what we'll do then. So after we finish this one, I will send, in about a month's time, I will send you my working manuscript for the next one. You can take a look at it and see whether or not you want to have a conversation about it on air.
All right, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'll be prepared for that too. I'm going to read the Apocrypha, read this, read that. Also, yeah, never mind. Okay. Yeah. We'll go through it.
Sounds good.
But David,
in the meantime, I would commend, I think it would be the thing you talked about with touch. That's actually not commonly spoken of in Christian churches, but it's everywhere in the Gospels.
Right.
If you if you want to have a little fun with this, get yourself go on the computer and find out every time the word touch is used in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and look at it, and you will discover it is almost always used in conjunction with the healing ministry of Jesus, where his physical body or the clothing that he's wearing comes in contact with somebody who's believing,
like the person touching his garment. And
that's right. In Mark chapter 5, there it is again. Yeah. In Mark chapter 5 and in parallels, Mark, of course, is the earliest one. And it's very clear in that case, Jesus is on his way to heal Jairus's daughter, a synagogue leader's daughter. Mm-hmm. He is focusing ahead of himself and the woman comes up from behind him and touches him from behind.
Mm-hmm.
He's not consciously aware that there's someone going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the power flows through him, goes into her. And there's two things that happen. The woman senses that her body has been made well. And he feels the flow of power. He stops in his tracks and he's on his way to pray for somebody else. And so he stops in his tracks and he says, "Who touched me?" And the word touch is used. And eventually the lady owns up to the fact that she touched him. And then he says, "Your faith has made you well." And then in a couple of other places in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it talks about how people would just reach out to touch the hem of his garment. And healing virtue would transfer through their faith, joined together with the presence of the Lord that was upon Jesus, and it would flow through the human contact.
Yeah.
Fascinating kind of thing. It's just
That's why
Catholics talk about holy relics. That's why they do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure they're quite correct, but regardless, it doesn't matter. The point is that anything that comes in contact with the divine can be an instrument through which God's power flows.
Right. And that's why, like in the church that I grew up in, they will bless the oil and pray over the oil.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
They will use the oil and so put it.
I'm in the Christian Missionary Alliance.
Yeah, and my mom would also get olive oil blessed and take the oil and put it on our heads and things like that. I mean, I could say, "Oh, why did she do that?" But at the end of the day, I defeated a lot of odds. I'm still here, so who knows? It might have worked. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a whole different conversation. Again, that's a third interview.
Yeah, because I'm like, I grew up in a Christian church, converted to Islam, and da 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 da. But I often tell people, I'm like, you talk against the church, but then it's like, what if the prayers that your grandmother, your uncle, your you know, your ancestors had used to pray for you is one of the reasons why you are who you are today.
Well, listen, you know what? I want to tell you one more story. Then I do have to go. Can I tell you one more story?
Yeah, go ahead.
You can figure out what you want to put in the interview or not, but here's what I can tell you. So I wound up going into the ministry. My dad had suffered much when he was a little boy. He got kicked by a horse when he was 6 years old, broke his jaw. It wrecked his eyesight. His sister saved his life, got him to a hospital in time. But he grew up Ukrainian when Stalin was slaughtering Ukrainians in the 1930s. The reason why East Ukraine is Russian is because Stalin ordered his troops to annihilate the Ukrainian farmers because they didn't want to go to collectives, and he killed them. Mm-hmm. And then he transplanted Russian people onto that soil, and that's how Ukraine became Russian. And so it was during that time when my dad was growing up, and of course his relatives and friends who died in the slaughter, then there was all kinds of violence and horrible things. But my dad's eyesight was ruined, and so he had Coke bottle thick glasses. And all of his days, he didn't know if there was a God or not. And so he would call himself either an agnostic or an atheist, depending on the day you talk to him. But anyway, so what happened was when his dad was dying, it was 1947. I was born 10 years later, 1947. And his dad was actually got emphysema and a lung condition because he smoked too much. He smoked himself silly. And he got this emphysema thing and he was dying of that. And my dad was holding his hand just before he died. And my grandfather, whom I never met, looked at my dad and said, "You're going to have three sons. The middle one's name will be David, and he'll be blessed of the Lord and go into the ministry because of the prayers of my wife." And then he died. Now, my grandmother, my dad's mother, used to pray 3 hours a day, seed time and harvest. And my dad was the 14th of 14. And every single relative told exactly the same story. Grandpa would go there and say, "It's seed time, put the seed in. It's harvest, go into the harvest." And she'd say, "Nee, nee, 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 book, gotta talk to God." She'd spend 3 hours a day, every day, praying. And anyway, the bottom line was the oldest son was going to go into the ministry. His wife left him. And back in the 1920s and 30s, nobody's wife left him. So grandmother started to pray that there would be another from her children who would go into the ministry. My dad was born when she was 50. And then the Lord spoke to my grandmother and said, "This is the one. It's going to be through this line." In 1956, my brother Tim was born. In 1957, I was born. In 1959, my brother Al was born. I am the middle child, exactly as my grandfather said. And I got the name David because Prince Philip was visiting Canada. And all the ladies in the ward who had babies were baby boys. My mother was there. And they're going to name me Philip. And so she said to the first lady, "What's the name of your son?" She said, "I'm going to name him Philip after the prince." And so she went to the next lady, "What's the name of your son?" "I'm going to name him Philip after the prince." "Oh, what's the name of your son?" "I'm going to name him." So she said, "Well, I'm naming mine David. That's how I got my name, David." But it was in complete fulfillment of what my grandfather had said when he was dying. And then when I saw her, I was 12 years old, and she was in the Ukrainian old folks home in Toronto. She looked at my dad and she said, "Etsin Boja, this is the son of God." And my dad said, "Everybody's the son of God." And she said, "Nye, nye, 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 nye. Etsin Boja, this one, this is the son of God that I've been praying for." And then when I was called into the ministry and I wound up going into that, my dad told my mom the story and she didn't know any of it. 10 years before I was born, my grandfather prophesied my name, my position in the family, and the fact that I would have a call to the ministry. And even my name. It was the prayers of my grandmother.
Well, David is one of the ancestors of Jesus. So it's part of the bloodline.
That's correct. Yeah, you'll find that in Matthew's gospel. It's all there.
Yep.
My friend, listen, I am out of time.
No, okay. Yeah. Well, in a month, we're going to do this again. Thank you for being a part of this podcast. Contact me if you need anything, and you have a great rest of your day.
Sure. Now, are you going to send me the links to this podcast?
Of course.
Okay,
of course.
Very good. I look forward to seeing you, and thank you ever so much for inviting me, and I'll book in. We'll do it again.
Likewise.
Yeah, God bless.
God bless you, too.
We hope you're leaving this episode feeling empowered. Remember, greatness is a choice. To stay updated on our latest content and continue sharpening your edge, hit that subscribe button. Let's keep grinding together. Remember to visit militantgrind.com.